Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, what would opening up gun companies to civil penalties for mass shootings mean to the industry? We talk with Adams Arms President Jason East. And would there be the votes for legislation along those lines? We talk with Senator John D. Cherry, the only hunter in the Democratic caucus. Governor Whitmer's second 100 days, the U.S. Senate seat, and a 2024 primary challenger already emerging in the Detroit-based 13th Congressional District against Congressman Sri Tanadar. We'll tackle this and more this week with host Kyle Malin, MERS publisher John Roerink, and reporter Samantha Shriver.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore, where we're going to start our next 100 days of the Governor Whitmer second term on Tuesday. And that means the legislature post-spring break is going to be operating maybe a little differently. And joining us to talk about it for the beginning of this podcast is a former senator and former state rep himself, Virgil Smith, out of Detroit. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm thankful for being here.
Well, you have been part of legislatures in the past where you were a Democrat and you were in the majority. And as you've watched this legislature operate here with a Democratic House and Senate and a Democratic governor, have you seen any similarities between what you saw being in the majority and this Democratic majority in the House?
You know, we didn't have the trifecta as they have today. And then I served under a Republican trifecta in the Michigan Senate. So they had a long laundry list of items under the Republican trifecta that I served under to get to. So I somewhat commend them on the unity that they've had in keeping their votes together, because I know how hard that is and getting the things that they've got done.
Do you think they're going to continue to be able to hold together, Virgil?
Well, I'm hearing rumblings that in the House that a couple of members may go on to do other things. So that could change the dynamics a little bit. But I commend, you know, definitely in the House with Speaker Tate. I think he's doing a yeoman's job, and so in the Senate too. So I think they got a good shot of keeping their you know, keeping things together going into the next election cycle next year, especially in the House, because they got it. If they keep the majority, then, you know, this election is very important in the House.
John, as I was talking with Virgil about this, and we're looking ahead here, this the very beginning of session, it has been a very kumbaya moment, almost celebratory move here by Democrats. But as we start diving into the budget here, and these House and Senate Democrats have had to take some really tough votes on these economic projects. I'm sure they'd rather have spent this money a little differently than how it has been spent. I think we're going to see some fissures appear. What do you think?
In some regards, you already have on the SOAR funding, and this is, I was going to ask Virgil about this too, how it's got to be enormously complicated with the narrow majorities that the Democrats have in both chambers, and how does that complicate it from a lawmaker's perspective, Virgil?
Well, it complicates things. You don't have any room. You can't let your quote-unquote marginals off the hook. You have no, you know, room for error. So, you know, so leading into the next election cycle, what Kyle was talking about, you know, that's going to get very complicated, you know, for the House. You know, how does a marginal take a vote off? Mm-hmm. Okay, you've had all these important caucus issue votes happen, but none of them have been able to take a vote off. So now they all have to own every single vote.
It just seems to me, Kyle, that what's going to trip them up again is what almost tripped them up last time, and that's the SOAR. I'm real curious to see how that proceeds. I mean, I could be wrong.
Well, I'm also hearing a couple of members, you know, you may have a couple of members, you may have one or two members run for a local office. So, you know, so you don't, you know, you go around from 56 to 55. Now you're 55 tied. Changes everything.
Well, I agree what you're saying also, John, on the fissures with the SOAR fund. I have a hard time believing there's going to be any more SOAR funding that gets approved with this legislature in the House and the Senate. I think that that's probably done. There was a lot of heartburn, I think, in that Democratic caucus to approve all that money for big business. I got to believe they wanted to spend that money somewhere. I think they felt like they did the governor a favor. And now as they're crafting this budget, I think that there's going to be a lot of sentiment in that caucus of it's our turn now. You know, that we helped the governor out with a couple big projects, but there's some spending priorities that we're extremely interested in, and we'd like to see those get pushed at this time. And hey, the legislature, and Virgil, you know this, you are the ones who get to write the budget bills. You're the ones who get to spend the money, and the governor at that point can only say no.
Correct. As I was always taught, is the executive branch proposes and the legislative branch disposes.
Yeah. So as far as the money goes, I would agree. Samantha, what's kind of your perceptions and what we're going to be seeing here for the next 100 days?
You know, I did want to ask the question, if you are a Democrat that while serving in the minority, you were opposed to SOAR funding. You know, I know that some brought up the point of why would I back SOAR if some of these economic incentives policies haven't been utilized to support minority-owned businesses. I've seen the claim of, you know, just not wanting to be involved in something that can be deemed as corporate welfare. But now that you're in the majority and you're supporting it and you're now on file in supporting it, are you a sellout?
Well, that's going into the next election, the House. You know, you have the next election cycle is next year. You have no room to breathe, so to speak. So you know, your marginals, how do they survive in that environment?
I do want to explore, because I know that there have been some issues that are very considered kind of Detroit versus everybody issues. You know, they're problems that happen within the city. Do you think those issues are going to be better discussed with this Democratic trifecta? Or do you think they could also be brushed under the rug as we look at redistricting?
Well, you had to go there. I was trying to stay away from me. I really was. But the Michigan Senate, you can make the argument, has the majority on the backs of pilfering, you know, the minority area in Detroit, Michigan, so to speak. They didn't do it in Flint. They didn't do it in Saginaw, but they definitely did it in Detroit. Now, what do we get from that? Our issues are sometimes a little different, say, in urban America than in, you know, suburban America. So do, you know, they went through a long laundry list of issues. Well, how about the urban issues, you know, and we haven't heard any talk on that. And that really, it puts more pressure on the Detroit members that are there to really step up and speak on those issues, you know, because our numbers are really down in the Michigan Senate.
And from your standpoint, then, if they don't deliver, does that just add to the cynicism? Do you see, and I know we've heard about this for years, it never really happens, where we see urban voters go to the Republican side just because the Democrats aren't delivering for them?
Well, what you've seen is Detroit is the shrinking of Detroit. 50, 60 years, the population has kept exiting, whether it's going into the suburban areas or just leaving the state altogether. So the byproduct of that is our bullpen in Detroit is not, we don't have the candidates that we once had stepping up to run for office. And, you know, so now we have Mayor Duggan as the mayor. You have Rashida Tlaib as the congresswoman, Sri Tanadar as a congressman. And I'm not, you know, I don't want to criticize anybody, but they're not Black. So, you know, so where do we go moving forward? I mean, do these districts in this Michigan Senate, do they stay like that? Or can we bring them back towards Detroit and, you know, get some semblance of representing our own area? Because, you know, I said I wasn't going to criticize anybody, but are the senators that represent, that are living in the suburban area now representing Detroit areas, are they really going to come in to really understand our issues and give and speak, you know, as we say, give truth to power to our issues?
And that will be a question. I know that's been a question as far as the U.S. Senate goes as well. Is there going to be a candidate from Detroit who's going to run in the Democratic primary against Alyssa Slotkin? Do you believe there will be?
At this point, I'll say this. There definitely won't be a native Detroiter running. So...
All right. Well, how about Hill Harper? I know you've talked to him. What do you think he's going to do?
I've already made the comment that he has not made the decision to be a candidate. He has not filed with the FEC his candidate paperwork. So he is not an official candidate. He is not collecting signatures. So, and I keep saying this, the shorter that time, we're a year away. You got to get 15 to 30,000 signatures. And then 100 of them have to come from half of the congressional districts. So, you know, the longer you wait to do that process, the harder it is to collect and the more expensive it becomes to collect.
As being somebody who's involved in the business, you know a little bit about this. And as you get deeper into the fall, the football games start going away, and the festivals and the fairs start going away as well.
Yes, it becomes harder and harder because it becomes cold. And the filing deadline is the third Tuesday in April of next year, so we're a year away.
As you're talking about Hill Harper, what is his connection to Michigan, though? I mean, is it – he's not a native, right? I mean, is it just that Michigan has an open seat and he wants to go for it?
So his connection, oddly enough, and you guys were talking about corporate welfare, I'm somebody that has supported numerous tax incentives, and one of them that I supported and I helped co-write with now Congressman Huizenga is the movie tax incentive. And he credits that as bringing him to Michigan. And then he was able to fall in love with our housing structure. And he bought a house in Boston Edison, the Fisher Mansion. And he's been here since 2015. So that's his connection.
You know, I can't help, and I know that we wanted to talk about various different things, but looking at the U.S. Senate race, I know when we had initially heard that Debbie Stabenow was retiring, there was this big excitement of like, oh my goodness, it's going to be such a big and vibrant Democratic primary. And now it seems like it's just going to be Alyssa Slotkin and Nasser Baydoun. And how did this happen? Why does no one want to jump in? I thought this was supposed to be exciting.
Yeah, me too. Well, you know, 93 is the last Democratic primary in the U.S. Senate. Here in the state of Michigan. And then Debbie Stabenow was able to get elected in 2000. And the powers to be are doing everything they can to make sure that 93 stays the last Democratic primary.
Because it's the last one you lost.
Correct. It's the last one they lost. And they do not want, they're doing everything. The way I see it, a bloody Democratic primary could lead to, you know, another Spencer Abraham, so to speak. And they do not want that to happen. That is correct. That is the last one we lost. And then Southeast Michigan was so split up. So Bob Carr from East Lansing, and he may not, and this is just my personal opinion, I was 14 during that, and I somewhat remember that race, but he may not have been the best candidate for Southeast Michigan. Actually, Joe Ferguson did quite well down here in 1993 down here.
What do you think of Nasser Baydoun? Do you think he could make any worthwhile strides in Southeast Michigan?
See, the problem there is the Chaldean community has been part of the Republican Party. You know, they've been with the Republicans for so long. Now you're going to run on the, you're not, nobody knows you, you know, on the Democratic side. Where's your connection to hardcore Democratic voters in a primary election? You know, in a primary election, these are your real voters. So I can't see where he gets it. He doesn't even have a base.
Are you hearing anybody yet for Congress against Sri Tanadar? Or is there kind of a wait and see? We'll see how he does.
John Conyers III is already out here.
Oh, he's already talking about it?
Oh, he sent out an email. He's raising money. He's working.
Oh, my. Okay. What's your impressions of John Conyers III?
I think he learned a lot from the last election. If you look at what he's doing today, he's definitely coming with a new approach.
What is that approach?
He's trying to show the lineage. He's trying to show that he has the relationships, especially within the Congressional Black Caucus. And he's trying to also show and not just run on the name. He's also trying to step out of it and become more of his own candidate this time around.
Well, that would be a change. That's for sure. He was not very impressive the first time that he ran.
Yeah, Congress is a tough thing to run for, though. I mean, just out the gate, you run for Congress. So, but he's not going to be the only one. You can rest assured he is not going to be the only one.
Well, that's how Sri Tanadar won the first time. You would think that there would be a lesson learned then among the Black community. If getting a member of Congress is a priority, it would seem that coalescing behind one, like we're seeing with the Democrats getting behind Alyssa Slotkin, is probably the best strategy.
Throughout the history, when have you seen within the African American community a Black politician? You know, I commend what U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow is doing. She realized that it's time to, you know, U.S. Senator Carl Levin did the same thing. I was around how we made the transition to Gary Peters. And now, you know, they're trying to make the transition to Alyssa Slotkin. When have you seen Coleman Young? There was no transition from him, you know. You know, that happened. John Conyers, there was no transition from him directly. I mean, he didn't even make the transition for his own son. And you get Rashida Tlaib.
Why is that? Is it a culture thing?
And no, I you know, something as I sit in Martha Scott's commission district.
Uh,
It's almost like, and I don't want to primary, and I don't want to primary her, but you get itchy feet. It's like, you cannot live forever. You know, the Bible, you know, if you read the Bible promises 120 years within in the Old Testament. You know, he gave us an expiration date. So, you know.
The headline, Virgil has itchy feet.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that, and maybe that will be another podcast. But we've got to let you go and move on to our other interviews. Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Senator. Former Senator Virgil Smith, now a political consultant in the city of Detroit. Joining us now on the podcast is Senator John D. Cherry. He is a Democrat from Flint. Appreciate you being on the podcast today.
Well, thank you, Kyle. I'm glad to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Do you think you're the only hunter in the Democratic Senate caucus?
That I'm aware of.
Do you think you're the only one in your caucus that actually owns guns?
No, I think there might be one or two other caucus members who own guns.
But it does kind of give you kind of a different perspective when you go into that caucus room, doesn't it?
I do have a little bit of different life experience that I bring to the table within the caucus. That's probably accurate, yeah.
The reason I bring this up is because gun safety legislation is going to be back in front of the legislature as we start off here in April. And one of the questions is going to be, what is the perspective of people who own guns when we're crafting legislation about restricting access to people who are viewed as a threat to themselves or others? What is the message that you're sharing with your colleagues on this and other gun safety bills?
Well, I mean, from a personal perspective, I think the red flag legislation is probably the easiest legislation that's come up. I mean, fundamentally, what that's about is making sure that people who are likely to harm themselves or others have a process which we make sure that we get them help and take away their ability to do that temporarily.
Because the other ones had to do with possession and had to do with what are you going to do with your guns and how are you going to purchase them and how you're going to register them, because it's going to change. It probably will change how you operate then or how others would operate.
Yeah. And it, you know, on the red flag legislation, actually, I mean, one of the things I've talked about with some of my colleagues is a change that I think needs to occur there with the penalty for if you violate an ERPO order. So right now, the penalty under the legislation that we passed is it's a 93-day misdemeanor. I think I've talked to some folks in some rural counties, like if we upgraded that to a serious misdemeanor or a high court misdemeanor, it'll help law enforcement because you need like that level in order to make a custodial arrest. So if you have somebody who violates the order, now what that means is you were ordered to surrender your gun and then you refuse to do so, like you can imagine that situation, it's going to make it easier for law enforcement to actually go and enforce the order. You know, if they're going to have to go to somebody's house, if they have the ability to make a custodial arrest and temporarily put them in the cell until they're able to go through and look through the property and what have you, as opposed to like holding somebody in the back of a cruiser while they go into the building. That's one thing I've talked about with some of my colleagues. I think there's an interest in upgrading that a little bit. It really did make sure that law enforcement has the tools that they need to handle that particular situation properly.
On the registration issue, I wonder if you could talk about how you respond to hunters who ask you, what is this going to mean?
In terms of the universal background check law? Yeah, well, the law that was passed and sent to the governor's desk is not universal registration. If you read through the text to that bill, you still only need to have a license for a pistol, which has been the case in Michigan for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And it says you can also get a license for a long gun, but if you don't, you know, you're required to have that background check. That's the way the legislation is written. So there is no universal registration requirement. I think that's something that people talk about, but if you actually look at the text of the bill, that's not accurate.
All right, so you're still going to have to go through a background check, but you don't need a license, correct?
Still do for pistols. We know you've always needed that for a pistol. But
right. It's just point of sale issue, right?
Correct.
You know, I know one time we spoke, Senator Cherry, zooming in on safe storage legislation, you described this as being very much about responsibility. I have had a few questions come to me, though, about what does this mean if you're someone who is concealed carrying a pistol in your own home? Would you be violating a safe storage law? If you're someone that has antique firearms that are for display and not for being utilized, could you be in violation? And also, does this also cover ammunition? Does that have to be safely stored? What would be your response to some of those three concerns?
Let me preface by saying I own guns. I have a gun safe in my house. My guns are locked up in my house. I have a 6-year-old daughter, 8-month-old son. We've already had a conversation about, you know, you don't go into the gun safe. You know, that's not, you know, an appropriate thing to be doing with my 6-year-old daughter, right? She doesn't have access to those keys. So it's, you know, not an issue. But a lot of the discussion that is occurring on this about, well, what if this? Literally, you could leave a loaded handgun on the bathroom counter in a public restroom, and there would be no penalty under this law until such time as a kid got a hold of that and killed, harmed, or threatened somebody with it. I don't see what the big deal is there. This is not a strenuous requirement that you don't give kids access to your guns. If you have a handgun for personal protection, you're living alone and you leave it on your bedroom dresser, well, there's nothing that's going to happen to you until such time as a kid comes to your whole house and gets a hold of that gun and does something with it. So really, I think a lot of the rhetoric around that is overblown. This is about making sure that if kids potentially could have access to your gun, that you are being responsible in the way that you store that gun and you make sure that a kid doesn't have access to it. And a lot of these what-if scenarios, I think we're going to see evaporate when this actually goes into effect.
Do you think that gun manufacturers should be held criminally liable if their product is used in a mass shooting?
Yeah, you know, I know that a number of my colleagues are looking to introduce legislation on gun manufacturer immunity. Yeah, I have been very pleased and happy with how Senator Chang has run all the hearings associated with these bills and the way the bill sponsors have been open to working on these issues. I think when those bills get introduced, they'll go through a rigorous committee process, and I'm not planning on prejudging it. The way that I am approaching this issue is I want to hear both sides. I want to hear the upsides and downsides of and the pros and cons on the argument, and I'll try to approach it to make the best decision for, you know, the people in my district and the people of the state of Michigan.
So you don't have a position on that right now. That's what you're telling me.
I've not taken a definite position on this. I'm keeping my mind open on all aspects of it.
All right. Well, let's move on to the Labor Committee, because on the Labor Committee, which you chaired, we've already moved a right to work repeal and bring back of the prevailing wage law. Do you expect more to come out of the Labor Committee this session?
Oh, yeah. I think we're going to have a busy committee. Those were two big items that you know, I was happy to get through the committee, and I thought we handled those committee hearings well. I'm glad that we got them done, and now we're going to go on to more issues.
What would you say is the next issues up on the agenda?
You know, I think we're going to deal with some public employee issues in the near future. Yeah, I have a bill deals with making sure public employers are providing information on new employees who are hired into bargaining units to the unions that represent them. You know, I've been working with Senator Schenck and Senator McDonnell Rivett on bills associated with moving corrections officers, conservation officers, and some state police officers who are not currently under the state retirement system to the state police retirement system. Back in the 90s, when most state employees were moved to a defined contribution, state police were not, and there were a lot of public safety employees who did get moved, who I don't think should have been moved, and hoping to correct that situation. And then, you know, there's a couple other bills here and there that I'm hoping we'll bring up in the near future.
Well, I know one of your first committee meetings with the Labor Committee, it dealt with workers' compensation. And I know that there was a legal firm that presented, there was some testimonies, and it was a pretty long and emotional committee hearing. What was the point in hosting that?
Really, we wanted to highlight that there are some issues with the workers' compensation system as it currently exists in Michigan. And I think there are some folks who may be bad actors in that realm, and we want to make sure that the laws we have surrounding workers' compensation are not allowing for bad actors to continue to be bad actors. So I expect, you know, sometime this year, there's going to be some bills introduced on that. I know Senator Bumstead introduced a bill dealing with some workers' compensation issues for volunteer firefighters and volunteer police officers. And I would like to bring that up this spring in the committee as well.
Senator Sherry, I also wanted to touch on maybe more of a broad subject here, dealing with Democrats attracting blue-collar voters. Republicans are really trying to lay claim to that voting demographic now. But as somebody who represents Genesee County, how do you connect and try and make sure that those traditional Democratic voters stay in your camp?
The way I go about my business is I try my best to lead a normal life. I do my grocery shopping. I go do stuff around town. I talk to people, and people are more than willing, particularly now that I've learned there's a difference between being a senator and being a rep. People are more than willing to come up and tell you about stuff, more so being a senator than when I was a rep. And, you know, I just listen to what's happened in people's lives, the challenges that people are facing. And it just so happens that most of my social circle is, you know, blue collar folks, right? So, and we talk on, you know, gun issues or what have you. This spring, I was at a conservation dinner. I rarely go to conservation dinners, but I was at one at UAW Local 659. And so, you know, folks were talking to me about what their feelings are on a lot of the gun issues, right? And those are folks that I've grown up with. And so I hear about it. And that's why going through some of the bills that we did now, I felt confident in understanding what needed to get changed in the bills as they were introduced, which we got changed, and getting those over the finish line. Because I'll tell you, everybody that I talk to understands the need for a background check. Most hunters, recreational shooters, folks who own guns understand the need to store your gun safely, make sure kids not having access to it. I listen to the folks that I've known for many, many years, hear the things that they're having trouble with, and that's the stuff I work on. And so, you know, a lot of it's been working on economic development stuff here locally, where, you know, Buick City was, you know, one of the largest industrial facilities, frankly, across the nation. You know, we had like over 20,000 people working there, That's a big redeveloping. That's been a big issue that we've been working on. We're hoping to get across the finish line. We got some agreements in place last year, and we need to get it across the finish line this year. So dealing with these pieces, making sure Michigan is the future of vehicle manufacturing, that's huge. Been dealing with mobile home issues. That's stuff that was brought to me by my constituents. So just making sure that you listen to your constituents, understanding the issues that they're facing. You know, and a lot of it's economic right now, trying to do your best by them.
Do you expect or anticipate this legislature will all look at changes to the current CPL system?
You know, no one's approached me about that. So whether there'll be bills introduced, I don't know. But I've not heard conversations about that yet. Something were to be introduced, and the question I'd be asking myself is, are we having an issue right now where people who have CPLs are committing crimes? Or is that like actually an issue? Yeah, I like to know before I take a position on something, I want to understand what the actual reality is, what's the data behind it. And that's kind of.
You haven't heard anything yet.
No, I've not heard anything yet.
Okay. Someone who's on the ground in the Senate chamber, there has been a lot of party line votes. How would you describe the ecosystem right now when it comes to bipartisan versus partisan relationships?
Yeah, you know, I guess I think it depends on the individual senator and how you approach it. You know, I've been trying to work on a lot of bills, you know, the bills that I've introduced, I've been trying to do a lot of bipartisan stuff out of the gate for my roster of things. Some of it has only been sponsored by Democrats, but I bet you we get some Republicans who vote on like correction officer pensions. My first bill to come out of the chamber was bipartisan. I expect most of my bills will have some Republican votes. I'll look if I see bills that I think are reasonable, for example, Senator Bumstead's bill that got referred to labor, I'm willing to bring those up. I was very lucky, I think, in the House last term, I served as vice chair on the Government Operations Committee with Representative Mueller, who was the chair. And that experience, you know, I get along great with Mike. We have a great relationship. And as you're well aware, Government Operations tends to be one of the most partisan committees that exists within the legislature, right? Stuff either goes there to die or move immediately. And I felt in that committee, we probably had the most genial committee government operations committee that's existed in the legislature. You know, Mike and I worked well together. We didn't always vote the same way on stuff that came out of committee, but, you know, I think we had a level of respect and we were willing to work together to try to get the best product possible, understanding the dynamics that exist. And that's kind of how I approach things. You know, there's going to be stuff where, you know, the repeal of the anti-worker right to work law, that was a party line vote. And I kind of knew it, largely that was going to be party line. I'd hope maybe there was one or two Republicans who would vote for it. And we did it. Folks had a chance to, we didn't subvert the committee process. Vice Chair Albert had the opportunity to ask questions in a rigorous way. We had folks from the chamber be able to, the manufacturers be able to speak as well. You know, that's kind of the approach that I take, is I try to treat people fairly, whatever side of the aisle they're on. And I think, you know, going forward, you know, there'll be stuff that there will be an opportunity for there to be some bipartisanship, and hoping we're able to do some of those items.
So with your labor committee and you're talking to union affiliated stakeholders, are those faces starting to change? And I ask this because I'm looking at the recent UAW presidency change, you know, with Ray Curry losing that position.
Yeah, I mean, there's always change that exists within the labor movement. And one of the things I think most folks don't realize is, you know, so I work a lot with my local trade unions, right? So the business managers are elected by their members, just like, you know, we're elected by our constituents. So I've had multiple different business managers and different locals that I've worked with based on what happens in their union elections. And so, I mean, I've seen turnover in my time in the legislature within the my local unions. It happens. And, you know, you work with whoever's there, and there's not a drastic difference because in terms of how that relationship works, because you're moving in the same direction almost regardless of who's there, because the values of the institution aren't really changing. So they, plumbers and pipe fitters local, the business manager retired, local 370. Now there's a new business manager. They still care about regulation of licensed trades and making sure our building code's enforced and making sure there's prevailing wage and all these things. Like the issues that they care about, they're the same, you know, and you know, the individual personality is different and the individual relationship is different, but it doesn't, I think, drastically affect our work as legislators necessarily, the changeover in those union elections, because the values of the organization aren't necessarily changing.
Senator Cherry, are you a member of the NRA?
I am not.
Have you ever been?
When I was younger, I was, yes.
Well, what made you not renew your membership?
I'll tell you the moment that I said I will never be a member of this organization.
Okay, please.
You know, you get all these fundraising calls, and I remember the fundraising I called where they said Obama was inviting the UN in to take away all of our guns. That's just, excuse my language, batshit crazy. And I'm not going to be a member of that type of organization.
Senator John D. Cherry, Democrat from Flint, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Joining us now on the podcast is Jason East. He is the president of Adams Arms. That is a Florida-based gun manufacturing company that was recently announced as the official rifle company for the Indiana Sheriff's Association's statewide Honor Guard rifle team. So congratulations on that, and thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Here in the state of Michigan, legislators are considering red flag laws and establishing them, putting them on the books, and this would allow the courts and the police to disarm an individual who has been deemed to be a threat to themselves or others. I know that these are not novel to the state of Michigan or unique here, but in general, they have received quite a bit of support from gun safety groups. Why are these not a good idea?
Well, I'm going to take this in kind of two tranches here. You mentioned the red flag laws. You know, we are all about not having guns be in the hands of people that pose or are deemed a threat. You know, however, our problem in the gun industry with red flag laws is, you know, it penalizes law-abiding citizens without due process, you know, and that's our whole thing in objecting to red flag laws is, you know, it violates someone's constitutional right without them being, you know, gone through that process. They haven't, you know, quote, had their day in court. And so, you know, that's our issue with that. You know, in terms of passing gun laws, it's basically simple. Criminals don't follow laws. And so passing more laws is only going to affect law-abiding citizens that are, you know, simply trying to protect themselves and their families. You know, what we are in favor of is actually enforcing the laws that we already have on the books, quit being lenient with violent offenders, and actually crack down and enforce the ones that are already on the books rather than, you know, a paradox of trying to add new laws that have proven to have no impact whatsoever.
I'm curious, is there anything else that can be done? I mean, is it education? I mean, because I've talked to a lot of gun owners that appreciate guns. They enjoy guns from a recreational standpoint. But they're concerned because they see these shootings. They've got family members, and they do seem to be on the rise. Is there anything else that we can do as a society or to sort of curb these?
I think the first thing that we have to do, especially when it involves police, right, because that's a big thing right now is, you know, police shootings and stuff like that are up. The first thing we have to do is change our culture, right? So the question is, why is this happening now, and why is it happening more often? You know, back in the 1990s, there was a huge spike in gun ownership in the United States in the late 80s and early 90s, and violent crime actually went down. So if you look at that, we can't necessarily say that more guns equals more violent crime. So why is it happening, right? And if you look at a lot of these instances, what were these people exposed to? They're exposed to violent movies. They're exposed to violent video games. They're exposed everywhere we turn around. It's violence, violence, violence. You know, things that I didn't see as an eight-year-old kid is now normal exposure for eight-year-old kids growing up today, right? And so we've evolved as that culture. You know, the media propagation of defund the police, right, has had a huge impact in the way society sees, respects, and looks at law enforcement. And so that's had a big thing. So the first thing we have to do is we have to change our culture with education, right? A few rotten cops doesn't affect the 99% that are honorable people, right? And so this whole movement based on a couple of bad apples is the wrong way to go there, and we have to change that culture. You know, you look at school shooting, right? I have school-age children, and so, you know, the last thing I want to do is have them exposed to a school shooting. You know, there are things that can be done immediately. You know, I am a big, as well as most people in our industry, are big proponents of arming teachers that are willing to go through a training course and carry. You know, we don't want to force all teachers to carry, but the ones that are willing and are willing to go through that training seems like a logical first step. The other thing that we can do is single point of entry. You know, now we've seen a lot of these shootings such as Uvalde and things like that, where, you know, people came in through a side door that was left open or someone let someone in. You know, single point of entry should be the norm. At Adams Arms, we're also working with some of our law enforcement partners and other in the industry to give the school resource officers tools that they need. You know, a lot of parents have said, we don't want school resource officers walking around all day with an AR-15 slung across their shoulder. And so because of that, a lot of school resource officers have to keep their weapons in the trunk. And so when a shooting breaks out, the last thing I want is the officer going to the parking lot, right? I want them engaging the threat. And so what we've done is we've reached out to a couple of our industry partners. We've developed a package that contains a backpack with a folding stock. So the firearm is completely, covered, if you will, in the backpack, concealed, whatever the word you want to use is. We've also put in there bolt cutters, trauma kits, anything, ballistic plates to protect the officer, anything that could actually help. You know, we saw in Uvalde the alarming videos of, law enforcement camped outside and not engaging. And let's look at what happened in Nashville. Once the law enforcement officers entered the building, in approximately 2 minutes and 14 seconds, the threat had been eliminated. So, that is a clear-cut case, again, where engaging the threat is the right way to go. And so, there's a lot of things that we can do to take impact now. But instead, what our politicians want to do is dance around this gun control issue and pass more laws and stuff that are threatening law-abiding citizens and doing nothing to address the criminals.
Let's talk about the gun industry a little bit. How many gun manufacturers do we have in the United States, roughly?
Well, that's actually a kind of a loaded question, because as an individual, I can submit paperwork to the ATF, and if I have CNC machining capabilities and stuff, I have the right to manufacture in my garage, right? So you actually have people that have a federal firearms license, and they have that manufacturing capability. Then you have people, like Adams Arms that, we do thousands of products every month. And so that's kind of a loaded question. And of course it varies, right? It varies based on, what's going on in the market, how hot and cold the market is, and things like that. But, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of manufacturers here in the United States. Depending on the statistics that you believe, there's believed to be somewhere between 350 and 400 million firearms in civilian ownership within the United States.
But as far as people who are actually making these firearms, a majority of them have to come from a handful of companies, don't they?
Yeah, it's always the law of averages, right? It's the 80-20 rule, right? The top 20% are manufacturing the 80% of the firearms.
And talking to lawmakers up here, we've heard the argument, and I'm sure you have two interviews around the country, where they will respond, it shouldn't be about locking down the school, it shouldn't be about doors, it should be about guns. I guess, how do you respond to that kind of argument?
A person that wants to do harm to other people is going to find a way to do harm to other people. So, is an assailant loose in a school with a knife or a machete or a bow and arrow or any other thing less lethal than with a firearm? All that is a deflection to take away from the fact that they can't use common sense to put some of these things that we're talking about in place to have an immediate impact. Do we need to do more? Absolutely. Do we need to do more with mental health? Do we need to do more with what our culture of violence in the United States seem to be? Absolutely. But these are immediate first steps that can be done today. We do not have to wait. It took terrorists bombing, using airplanes as basically bombs, for us to immediately put things in place at our airports that made them, quote, safer. So why is nobody acting now? Why do we keep having these conversations? Single point of entry could be done immediately, but yet everybody wants to pass it off. We say that the school children are our most precious asset, but we don't see the action happening that could be done immediately that could help alleviate those dangerous threats.
One of the things that we've talked about in Michigan is opening up gun manufacturers to liability for mass shooting. What would laws like that do to your industry?
Well, you know, here's our problem with that. First of all, as a manufacturer, you know, very few of our sales go directly to the consumer, right? So most of our sales go to a distributor who then sells to a dealer, or larger dealers buy from us. And then, you know, we have no idea who's going to come in after the fact and purchase our product. You know, do we hold Chevrolet and General Motors responsible when someone uses one of their products in a dangerous way?
Well, some would say, though, that the cigarette companies were held responsible for the deaths of people who died of lung cancer.
Well, I would argue that the warning's on the package, and if you continue to do it, you're taking that risk, and you're agreeing to basically play Russian roulette with lung cancer. You know, I'm not sure that it's an apples to apples comparison. Okay. You know, let's look at alcohol. Alcohol destroys families. There are more drunk driving deaths in the United States than there are people killed by guns, and nothing good comes out of alcohol. If we ban guns, yes, you know, there could be some correlation to reducing criminal shootings. But what about the people that use them successfully today to protect themselves that'll no longer have that ability to do so?
So you're saying if gun manufacturers are opened up to liability, what would happen to the industry?
Well, I mean, eventually, you know, if they use that as a catalyst, it would probably result in especially smaller manufacturers being sued into non-existence. You know, the gun control advocates have actually, you know, I think realized that most Americans are not going to go for an all-out gun ban. And so what they've done today is they've made it harder for manufacturers to obtain financial services and insurance. You know, as a gun manufacturer today, the pool of people that'll actually write general liability insurance and even property insurance is a small pool. You know, I've argued time and time again, the chances of a storm destroying my property, whether I'm making pencils or firearms, is exactly the same. However, insurance companies today in a lot of states can discriminate against firearms manufacturers. Now, in Texas and other places, there's actually litigation going on right now that are trying to snuff out and eliminate some of that discrimination. You know, if you opened it up to full-fledged liability, then absolutely, that's opening an avenue to be able to go in and sue some of the smaller manufacturers out of existence.
Do you think a solution would be arrived at faster if firearms themselves hadn't become a political issue? Because it seems like if you look at the rhetoric of the NRA, I mean, they're hard right. And then I think it elicits a response. And it seems like it's just become a political issue, period.
Yeah, I think that's why the politicians don't want to act. This is one of those instances, in my opinion, where, you know, bipartisan cooperation and things like that would go a long way. You know, I mentioned 9/11 earlier. You know, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you do, you know, for at least a month or two after 9/11, we weren't Democrats, we weren't Republicans, we were freaking Americans. And everywhere I went, I saw American flags displayed, they were thrown over overpasses, people pumped their fist and cheered and things like that. And then, you know, eventually that wore off and we went back into our fighting each other and who's right and who's wrong. And I can't do this because of that. And if you won't give me this and this bill, I'm not going to give you this. And, you know, that's my point is if the children are our most precious asset, which we say they are, you know, put all of that crap aside and for the sake of school safety, you know, let's do something immediately.
To John's point, though, why do you think that this issue has become as politicized as it is?
I think it's one of the things that gets people riled up. You know, politicians don't tend to talk about things. The media doesn't tend to talk about things that doesn't, you know, try to stir emotion. And so because this is such a hot button topic, right, between people that are staunch defenders of the Second Amendment, and they believe that shall not be infringed truly means shall not be infringed. On the other hand, you have people that, you know, have never been exposed to firearms and things like that. And a lot of those people tend to, you know, have a fear. They have a fear of a firearm. It is astounding the number of things that I see on the news that around firearms that are just not true and are just totally inaccurate.
That leads me to another question I wanted to ask you. We were talking before the podcast that Adams Arms is in the AR platform. And we've heard, and I think Chuck Schumer was one, I've heard other people quote, you know, that these kind of guns, there's no need for them to even exist. And I guess as someone who works in that platform, how do you respond? What's the value of even there being the ability to buy an AR?
Well, you have to remember the calibers and stuff that these weapons and firearms on the AR platform, you know, utilize are much the same calibers that you see in other types of rifles, whether it be, you know, lever action or bolt action or what have you. The attractiveness of the AR platform is its versatility, right? So it can be customized and optimized for a lot of different scenarios. You know, I've been pretty fortunate in my life from a financial perspective. And so, you know, I am able to go out and obtain firearms that are, you know, kind of designed and I have dedicated to certain functions, right? So if I'm going out and I'm just long range shooting, you know, I have a specific 308 platform for that. Or if I'm going to hunt deer, I may have a Browning bolt action that I'm using to hunt for that, right? And so, you know, I may have six or eight different firearms in the same caliber that I use for different functions, but not everybody has the ability to do that, right? And so if you take the AR platform, you know, it can be used for hunting. It can be used for personal protection. It can be used for long range shooting, and it has the ability to accessorize. Like I can use a lot of different optics. I can use a lot of different weapon lights. I can use a lot of different grips without making a lot of different changes. And so its versatility is what makes it an attractive offer for a lot of people, you know, because you can change it to suit the environment for which, you know, you need it to be accommodating today. And that may be a different accommodation tomorrow.
So what would happen if Congress abolishes or says we can no longer have assault rifles? What would happen to your industry?
Well, you know, first of all, their definition of assault rifle, we always ask, what is that? You know, there is no such thing as an assault rifle. And it's a made up term that they have used to instill fear. Now, if they come back and say, hey, you know, civilians can no longer own AR-15s any longer, you know, much like they did during the ban, you know, during the 1990s that carried forward 10 years into the 2000s, then, you know, it would have a drastic effect on our industry because, you know, now those would only be allowed to be manufactured for law enforcement and for, you know, military use. And, you know, although most companies do fulfill orders for both of those, the consumer side is obviously the largest, you know, piece of that pie.
All right. Well, we got to end it right there. Jason East, he is president of Adams Arms, Florida-based gun manufacturing company. Appreciate you spending some time with us here on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the time.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the Murders Monday podcast. Thanks to our guests today, former Senator Virgil Smith, Senator John D. Cherry, and also Jason East from Adams Arms. Post-production of the Murderous Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. I'd like to thank our sponsor again this week, AT&T, for this and all our other podcasts. For the boss, John Roerink, and Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.